Click kaya959.co.za.
This is how we do it.
To download the Point of View podcast.
Well, thank you so much for staying with us. I have been meaning to talk about this for a while, and, you know, we just were looking for the right person to talk to. And this is about what's happening in Sudan. And of course, you know, a lot of the media's eyes has been putting a lot of focus on what is happening in Gaza, for instance. And one may say it's because you have media houses like Al Jazeera who have relentlessly gone and covered that story. And, I mean, the world really would not know what is happening in Gaza if it were not for Al Jazeera. And I do want to single them out because they've been with that story for the longest time, even when they were banned by Israel, for instance, in Israel. So, you know, it's the media has a lot to do with how some stories are covered. And unfortunately, what's happened here with the story in Sudan is that we do not have cameras in Sudan. We are unfortunately relying a lot on institutions, organizations that do have ground forces on the ground who are able to gather some data. So it does sometimes take a while to report on something accurately as what is happening in Sudan. But I can tell you now, that story is dire and it does need more attention. So we've asked a researcher at Human Rights Watch covering Sudan, Mohammed Osman, to join us and maybe help us really unpack what is happening there. Very good evening to you, and thank you so much, Mr. Osman, for talking to us.
Thanks a lot for having me. Thanks a lot.
You have done a lot of work, and you've been watching what's happening in Sudan quite closely for some time. And we are hearing now this is a humanitarian crisis. Take us back to how we got here to get ourselves where there is hunger, insecurity, and what the UN is now calling a humanitarian crisis.
Thanks a lot. I mean, maybe let me just start with, I mean, we have this thing in English when we would say, no news is good news.
Yes.
And when it comes to Sudan, it's never really the case.
Mm.
Because one of the main things we have, as you just say to yourself, we're not really getting a lot about what's happening in Sudan. But what we are getting so far is enough to ring the alarm bell in terms of this as being the world's worst humanitarian crisis. Mm. We are not really getting myself being from Sudan as well, we're not getting the world's attention. But also let me bring it up to the fact that Africa, you know, us being Africans as well, we're not getting Africa's attention at the same time.
Mm.
We are looking at a situation from El Fasher, the capital of North Darfur, when people are reportedly being fed with animal feed. We are looking at a situation when people struggling with access to food, education, health at different parts. We are looking at ongoing abuses at different parts of the country at the same time. So we really, when, you know, the lack of, and I think this is the sad part, I mean, Sudan, the history of Sudan, the story of Sudan, has been so much defined by the conflicts of the last years. But before that, there was a revolution. There was a protest movement that ousted the dictatorship, wanted to bring Sudan on a trajectory of democracy. And that story kind of being forgotten, that it's also part of what we have to be talking about now at the moment. And people are really trying to bring again the narrative of what's happening, trying to have a voice. You mentioned Gaza, for example. It's not a situation which is, I think Sudan is pitting against Gaza. I think it's a situation which is the narrative about the conflict in Africa always being defined as another, you know, another conflict, right? Mm-hmm. Africa always have conflicts, black people killing each other. It's not that. It's much more complex than that.
Yeah.
Regional powers as well, very involved in it.
Yeah, I mean, you say that, and I think it's very, very important because it's been on this cycle, has it not, where there is a coup, there is a military takeover, and then there is a civilians who come through, and then there is what seems to be an attempt to have a democracy, and the cycle starts again, all over again. So it's not as if there isn't an attempt to come out of, military rule. It's that unfortunately, the cycle just keeps repeating itself.
Absolutely. I mean, it's a vicious cycle. And I think for the first time, I mean, just saying, like in from 2018 and 2019, when you had young people, and it was myself was there at the beginning of the protest movement and after, and the mantra was freedom, peace, and justice. Mm. And if you can really, really look at what these three words means, right? People in Khartoum, the capital, in Atbara, in north of Sudan, were saying, we are with Darfur, for example, right? We are looking at a situation which is like people realize the complexity of the situation in Sudan. The world forgot about them. The world left them behind. They treated them as irrelevant in so many ways. We are looking at I was talking to someone a few days ago in Darfur, and they were talking about, I mean, just, you know, I think many people know about it by now, the access to the food situation. Yes. At the same time.
Yes.
The United Nations is not even present there, of course, because of the obstruction of access by the both of the warring parties. But the UN itself isn't really pushing much to challenge the warring parties, because this is not only about humanitarian access. It's about direct humanitarian and human rights violations being committed by the both parties. That is contributing to the starvation, is contributing to the suffering of the population on the ground.
Let me ask you this, Mohammed, as you make the point that the UN is not even present. Why is it that the UN are not sending forces, UN forces, number one? And number two, you know, where is the AU?
I mean, this is actually a very good question. If you look at the crisis in Darfur, you know, ages ago when it started the conflict, the first meeting of the Peace and Security Council was on Darfur. And now we can look at it and it is nothing, right? There's different mechanisms being created by the AU. There's different panels being created by the AU, investigations by the African Commissions, but there's really nothing. So Africa, in the political sense, is very absent from engaging with the situation on Sudan.
Yeah.
And we're not really seeing that. And I'm saying Africa in the political sense to distinguish it as well from the kind of the civil society engagement. I mean, a year ago, or maybe 2 years ago, we had the rebel support forces leader, Hemeti, was in South Africa, was welcomed by South African officials. And instead of being held accountable to the crimes he committed in Sudan at the same time, we are looking at a time when, at the height of the conflict in Darfur, we had a panel that had been led by, you know, former President Mbeki, that had great, amazing, interesting recommendations about how to deal with the conflict and accountability in Sudan. South Africa in particular is a very missed voice into the conflict in Sudan. For me, what the fact that the world and Africa in particular are engaging in Sudan is very baffling. I mean, we're looking at a situation where I think just for me, it's a situation of like how we can bring that to the focus again.
Yeah.
How we make African lives matter, how we can bring this to the fact that it's not just a civil conflict, it's not a tribal conflict, it's not like communities killing each other.
Mm.
It's a conflict where regional powers are really involved, really engaging. There is a constant supply of weapons, as established by our reports, other groups, including the UN panel of experts, and that continue to kind of fan the flames of the conflict in Sudan.
And I think that is part of what we don't discuss enough, to say whether you call them rebel movements, whatever it is that you call them in different parts of the continent, that often, you know, are part of this unfortunate, you know, infliction of violence on their own people, that somebody's funding those wars. And we don't go deep enough to discussing who is funding those wars and who stands to benefit from the wars.
Exactly. I mean, this is the war about profit. It's a war about how much you can generate profit from it at the same time. I mean, we can look at one country that UN panel of experts on Sudan, Darfur, and our reporting, other groups reporting, media reporting, including the New York Times and the Washington Post, which is the United Arab Emirates, has been actively funding, promoting, and supporting the rapid support forces, the other side of the fight in Sudan, right? It's a group that had a political conference with allies in Nairobi, in Kenya. So there is a coverage, there is a protection for them by these regional actors that continue to contribute to the conflict. At the same time, we look at the Sudanese armed forces, who have been, for historical reasons, for a long time, being supported by countries like Turkey, Qatar, and Egypt. So each one kind of getting their piece of the cake in the conflict at the same time. What matters here, I mean, just to kind of bring it back to the humanitarian issue at the same time, that it's such an underfunded response. We are not seeing the UN kind of calling the abuses out as much that they should be doing. We're not seeing that presence in areas of conflict. And many of the humanitarians would agree with that. You know, there is a reason why we have humanitarians, because there is a conflict. So we need to be there, right? So we need to be present there. And if we're not present there for a reason or not, and again, we have this conversation in Gaza, they need to be, you know, to be quite outspoken about it. Sure. They shouldn't be quiet about it or silent about it.
It's often one of those cases where people looking from the outside in want to identify who's the good cop, who's the bad cop, who is the evil and who is not the evil, who's the good guy. In this scenario, it's not that simple. When you listen to civilian accounts, particularly documented by yourselves at Human Rights Watch, you get the sense that civilians are really in the middle of they're sandwiched between really warring factions, and there is nobody who's better here. And it's difficult. Yes, politically you may come up with some different assessments of who is wrong, but the civilians don't see it that way. In the end, right now, they feel like they're sandwiched between warring factions, and they don't have a way out.
I mean, just to give one kind of an example here, when we were looking at cases of sexual violence, which is such a rampant trend throughout this conflict, we are looking at situations when in most of the cases of sexual violence being perpetrated by the rapid support forces, for example. At the same time, many of the survivors of sexual violence were double victimized because the Sudanese armed forces or the government were blocking aid, including access to treatment for rape survivors that they really needed it. I mean, yes, they didn't commit the rape themselves, but they blocked the access to any kind of medical treatment, aid treatment that they really needed at the same time. So this is one example about how both parties contributed to the humanitarian, to the civilian suffering. For a long time, and I know this is not probably the place to go for longer detail, is we had, even before the war itself, after the coup in 2021, we had an international approach that actively sidelined civilian voices. They focused on the kind of the pragmatic approach of talking to the people in power to stabilize the situation. The end of that is the conflict we're having now. So it's also very important to look at the failure of the international approach and international engagement, including the regional engagement at the same time, that allowed the warring parties to continue until now to act with impunity with their actions against Sudanese civilians.
So we currently have figures like, for instance, 14 months, I believe, with no food and fuel, blocked by RSF. And of course, on the one side, you've got government forces themselves, as you said, you know, who are denying access to civilians as well. But there are accounts that I've been watching where civilians are saying, on the one hand, you are blocked by, let's say it's RSF forces, and they would ask you, you know, for instance, to identify yourself, but particularly what your ethnicity is. And then a couple of hundred meters on the one side, then you bump into the government forces. They themselves want another form of identification. And so this constant also I suppose, bringing up of ethnicity has also gotten the waters quite muddied. Maybe just talk to us about what the relevance of this ethnicity thing is about with this particular fiction.
I think it's especially if you're looking at certain parts of the country, ethnicity is such a relevant factor in terms of driving the abuses. When you're looking at the rabid support forces, I mean, the major composition of them, they're coming from Arabic nomadic tribes in the Darfur, so-called the Janjaweed in the early days of the conflict in Darfur. We're also looking at this, I mean, which is, for me, this is also very interesting. The same group of people that we call like African non-Arab communities in Darfur being persecuted by both sides at the same time. So in some ways, ethnicity plays a role in terms of being a victim, a survivor, but also in terms of the mobilization of people. We are looking at the serious risk of a country to be even more disintegrated into ethnicity lines because everyone feels like there is no state to protect me. Therefore, every group of people can carry guns and can establish a presence or power or privilege or access to wealth through that. And this is the history of Sudan for quite some time. However, it's not necessarily the only thing that is happening, because we are seeing how ethnicity is also being manipulated through payments, through interests of powers in Sudan or powers outside of Sudan. And you can talk about Darfur, you can talk about East Sudan, but it's a serious thing because people are fleeing from areas in Darfur to areas in the north. And then the security forces affiliated with the army would arrest them because they will accuse them being spies. Mm. But it's ethnically being motivated. At the same time, you can go back to Darfur. And myself and my colleagues were 2 years ago in Chad interviewing many of the refugees who fled from West Darfur, who have been a site of campaigns of ethnic cleansing. So it is very relevant in the context of the conflict. And it's going to be worse, I'm afraid.
Are you optimistic? Is there some light at the horizon, or, you know, what needs to happen for there to be light at the horizon?
For many years, I think when we talk to many of the people we interview and we work with, optimism has been a key driver of their work, and myself included. I'm afraid we are in a situation now that is a mixture of anger, despair, lack of hope, of getting the attention of people around us, our neighbors in the continent in particular, to push and really engage with the real issue here. The need for democracy, the need for human rights protection, the need for accountability. It's been decades of impunity. So I would say it's a mixture of people like really losing hope, people really focusing on day-to-day basis. If you're talking to people who are like, they're eating animal feed, how much really of hope you can expect from them? They would tell you that we just need to be alive tomorrow, or like, I need my children to be alive tomorrow. There is very little hope in so many pockets of the conflict in Sudan about how the situation is going to turn out, because there is very little engagement. There's little progress that is happening.
I really appreciate you talking to us this evening. And yes, I think we need to do more. We need to talk about this more and obviously shine a bigger spotlight on this. I really appreciate it. Researcher at Human Rights Watch covering Sudan, Mohammed Osman. And I promise you, we'll come back to the story. This is not the end. We have to keep an eye on this one, because as we are hearing, hundreds of thousands have died and we are not even hearing the tip of the iceberg.
Click kaya959.co.za.
This is how we do it.
To download the Point of View podcast.